Good evening. Well, let's take up our tithes and offerings. It's amazing how I can draw out these subjects, isn't it? We just seem to roll on and on and on and never get finished. Well, we're considering the subject of that of progressive revelation as it relates to another subject of continuity and discontinuity as to what continues out of the Old Testament into the New Testament, what drops off. And we have seen it's a very complex subject. It's not simply answered. And to show the difficulty of it, we have chosen the theme of tithing. And we've covered a great deal of ground, starting with the first mention of tithing with Abraham and Melchizedek and then Jacob, and then coming down to the Mosaic legislation, the several periods of changes that God implemented through that, and then the Babylonian captivity, and then the return from captivity and the rebuilding of the temple, reestablishing of the priesthood, and the principle of supporting the priesthood by the tithe. And then last week, we looked at the period of time between the closing of the Old Testament in the book of Malachi and the beginning of the New Testament with the appearance of John the Baptist, the 400 years that God did not speak through any prophet, but heaven was silent. And tonight we take up there at that point, and now looking this evening at some New Testament references to the word tithing. We're now ready to examine tithing under the New Covenant. In doing so, we will examine the usage of the word, which appears only 8 times in 3 different settings or context. In doing so, let us not then forget the developments which occurred in the 400 years between the closing of the Old Testament era and the beginning of the New Testament era. Last time we looked at three of these such developments. They were the building of Herod's temple in Jerusalem. And there we saw that God never authorized that. He authorized Solomon's temple, but he never authorized the temple in Jerusalem at the time of Christ, and yet Jesus called it his Father's house, even though it was considered by him a den of thieves. But there was a temple there, and it had to be supported, and it was supported by the tithes of God's people. Also, the rise of the Jewish synagogue occurred during this 400-year period. God never authorized that. There was no revelation to start that institution, and yet it was felt to be necessary by the Jews, particularly because of the decline in the temple, and then them being dispersed in foreign lands. And then the compiling of the Jewish Talmud, a large, huge collection of writings in which the rabbis attempted to give detailed interpretation of how to apply the law of Moses to given sets of circumstances. And all of those three developments relate in some way to our subject of tithing. In looking at the 8 references in the New Testament, the first 2 references are found in Matthew 23:23 and Luke 11:42, and they refer to the same incident. Let's look at those 2 passages, Matthew 23 and verse 23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay tithe of mint and nice and cumin, have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat or strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Then over in Luke chapter 11, you'll note there in verse 23 we just read the usage of the word tithe. In Luke 11 now, and verse 42, same context, "Woe unto you, Pharisees, for ye tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass over judgment and the love of God. These ought ye have done, and not leave the other undone." Now, in the context here, Jesus addresses the tithing as practiced by the Jewish religious leaders, namely the scribes and the Pharisees. And these two groups represented the cream of the crop of Judaism present during the ministry of Jesus. These were the role models. These were the groups which kept the most serious in their approach to obedience to the Old Testament laws. As a group, Jesus denounces the hypocrisy which existed in their religious approach to God and His laws. He noted how they were careful to tithe on the minute seeds of their garden herbs. This would be like finding a dime on the street and making sure you gave a penny in the church offering plate on Sunday. Any of you tithe that minutely? I make about 20, 25 cents a week looking for money in the parking lot. Somebody said one time, "Why you always go around with your head down? Why are you so discouraged?" And I said, "This is how I get my income." Particularly good in grocery stores where they're putting groceries in and pulling them out and so forth, pull money out, and they're drop service stations as well. I'm not going to tell you where I go unless you get there ahead of me. But crude illustration, find a dime, make sure you give a penny. This was how minute the scribes and the Pharisees practiced tithing. Jesus said that they were overlooking the more important duties of the law, which were judgment, mercy, and faith. And these involved the personal way in which they related to God and their neighbors. In other words, very punctual in their tithing, but did not have an important relationship with God and their fellow man. Self-centeredness. Jesus described their actions as that of straining out a gnat out of one's food or drink while swallowing a camel. He then concluded that while they were performing their religious acts of tithing, they were not to overlook the things which were more important. And we'll come back to this later. The second reference is located in Luke 18:12. And in this context there, Jesus addressed the self-righteousness found in the Pharisee, who prided himself in the fact that he tithed of all of his possessions. Let's now go to that section, Luke chapter 18 and verse 12. Bear with me just a moment. Start in verse 9, "And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee, the other a publican," or a tax collector. "The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, proud of himself. God, I thank thee that I'm not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week, and I give tithes of all that I possess. In other words, he covers the whole scope, everything, down to the minute detail. This activity of the Pharisee led him to believe that he was more righteous than others. That is, that his practice of devotion superseded that of others because he was more minute in the application of tithing. Jesus rebuked this attitude. And these are the only two references to tithing found in the four Gospels, which describe the earthly life and ministry of Jesus. And the important thing to note is that both of these references refer to Old Testament usage and to the current Jewish practice at that time. We're still under the Mosaic economy, and these two references in the four Gospels, only two here, all refer to Old Testament usage and practice. The only other usage of the word tithe in the New Testament is found in the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. If you would, turn there. And here it's used five times in this one setting or context. Three times in the Gospels, two different settings, and then five times here in one setting in the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. The word is found in verse 5, verse 6, and verses 8 and 9. It's in the context of Melchizedek and Abraham in that relationship, which we looked at in Genesis 12, and then also in connection with the comparison between the priesthood patterned after Melchizedek and that which was established by God through Moses, the Levitical system, contrasting those two priesthoods. Let's begin in verse 4. Dealing with the character of Melchizedek, king of Salem, and the priest of the Most High God. Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. And verily they that are of the sons of Levi, who receive the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people. Notice Abraham gave a tenth, not of his own money, but of the spoils of the battle. He gave it. Wasn't commanded to. He gave it. But under the Levitical system, under Moses, there was a direct command instituted by God. So it was no longer an option. It was regulated by the revelation of God. To take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, that's the Jews. They weren't authorized to go out and collect tithes from the Gentile nations, but of the Israelites, though they came out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose descent or pedigree or genealogy is not counted from them, still speaking of Melchizedek, received tithes of Abraham and blessed him that had the promises. And without all contradiction, the less is blessed of the better. That is, Abraham was the less and Melchizedek was the superior. And here, men that die receive tithes, referring to the Levitical order. But there he received them, of whom it is witnessed that he liveth. As I may so say, Levi also, who received tithes, paid tithes in Abraham. For he was yet, that is, Levi hasn't been born, he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Now see, what this is showing is that the Melchizedekian priesthood was superior to the Levitical, because Levi hadn't even been born yet. So he's the inferior, Melchizedek is the superior. So we must never get it turned the other way around, as if the purposes that God had with Israel superseded that which preceded it. The whole dealings here with the nation is an inferior system in comparison to what preceded it. And what will then follow after this system, Bob, is carried away, and the New Testament covenant in the church is to be administered under the kingdom of Christ. Verse 11. If therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law. Now notice, the law of Moses set forth the Levitical priesthood. What further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? Why is there a need of another priest to appear out here on the scene in the future that's going to be superior to the Levitical order that was headed up by Aaron? Who was Aaron?
Moses'
brother. Okay? Moses gives the law. The priesthood is headed up by Moses' brother Aaron. Now watch carefully. All of this which God is putting in place is at a time in the future going to be annulled and done away with. Watch this now. For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the what? The law. Notice that. God gave the law, and he's going to change the law. Because the law involved the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, which was inferior to the priesthood that existed prior to that. And the new priesthood is going to be built upon, not upon the Levitical priesthood, but upon that which was found in Melchizedek. Verse 13, for he of whom these things are spoken pertaineth to another tribe, of which no man gave attendance at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord, that is Jesus, sprang out of which tribe? Judah. Of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. Then how in the world can Jesus be a priest? You see how the Jewish leaders, Bob, would say, you're coming claiming that you're the Messiah and that you're a priest. You don't even belong to Levi. You're a phony. You don't have the proper credentials. Of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning the priesthood. And it is yet far more evident, for that after the similitude or the likeness of Melchizedek, there ariseth another priest. There's going to be a priest come in the future out here. Now notice, class, this is being predicted by the Old Testament itself. It's predicting an era coming in which the Levitical order is going to be set aside and replaced by a superior order of worship. So, the appearance of Jesus Christ and his work is not something new that was unknown in the Old Testament. It was predicted. For it is yet far more evident that after similitude of Melchizedek there ariseth another priest who is made not after the law of a carnal commandment, or a fleshly can also be translated a legal commandment. But after the power of an endless life, for he testifieth, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. That's a quote from the 110th Psalm. We won't take time to go back there and look at that. But the 110th Psalm prophesied that under the reign of Messiah, there would be a priest. He would be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. That's predicted. Verse 18, for there is verily a disannulling, notice that, of the commandment going before for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof. For the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by the which we what? We draw nigh unto God. Well, that almost makes me want to stop and preach there, but I dare not do it. Did you see in verse 18 the word disannulling of God's commandment? Folks, God changes His commandments. The idea again that all moral commandments are a reflection of the eternal moral character of God and cannot be altered does not fit in to this passage right here. God is altering His commandments. He gives a certain order, He annuls it and replaces it with something far better. Built upon in the ministry of Christ of how we draw near to Him, jumping over all that He did in that parenthetical period in the history of Israel and ties it back in to Genesis 12, there with Abraham, who is given the promise. It's a wonderful thought that when you read in the book of Romans and Galatians and so forth, how that the law was added to the promise. 400 years later, the law was added till the seed should come. And when the seed comes, the law of Moses then is replaced with a better covenant, built upon better what? Promises. Get that? Better promises, like God made to Abraham. Well, as I say, there are some wonderful thoughts there. Paul here is showing the superiority of the priesthood of Melchizedek, which preceded the Mosaic law. It is superior to that of the Levitical system, which was instituted under the Mosaic law. Paul explains that Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek, and that this was the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy found in Psalm 110, verse 4. This change of the priesthood, now this is the crucial text, the kicker in this. This change of the priesthood necessitated a change in the law. Verse 12. Leading to the annulment of the commandment previously given through Moses. Since the main purpose of tithing under the Mosaic law was to support the ministry of the priesthood and the temple worship, this would mean that if those ministries are changed, then the imposed laws concerning tithing would also of necessity be changed. Do you follow the logic of that? If the system of the priesthood and the sacrificial system is changed, then the method of supporting that is of necessity. It is necessity must change. If you get the argument of the book of Hebrews, is that the Jewish Christians were being charged by the unbelieving Jews, their brethren, with being apostates. You've left the faith. You don't have access to God anymore because you're not going to the temple. You're not offering up sacrifices. You're cut off from God. You've apostatized. And see the pressure? If you had been a Jewish convert to Christ, that they're pulling one, they're tugging you to go back to your countrymen. And they would say, the Christian rebuttal would say, but we do have access to God. It is through Jesus Christ. And the Jewish rabbis would give a rebuttal to that, say, but he's a phony. He's not who he says he is. And furthermore, you don't have a priest to intercede for you. And the Christian believing Jew rebuttal was, but we do have a priest. His name is Jesus. Well, that doesn't settle it. The Jewish rebuttal is, but you don't have a biblical priest. This Jesus came from Judah, not from Levi. He's a phony. And the Christian rebuttal to that is, but we do have a biblical priest. A priest after the order of Melchizedek. And you see how this whole debate is running through. Paul used to be in that other camp. He knew how to debate because that's the way he debated. And so he's saying, hold fast. Don't go back to that system. It's changed. There's a better covenant here in place, and Jesus is the mediator of that better covenant, of which that old covenant merely was but a type and a shadow which could make nothing perfect and only pointed for the one who was to come and perfect that which only it could bring about in perfection. So all five references to tithing in Hebrews, now this is important, refer back to the practice prior to the Mosaic Law, Abraham and Melchizedek, and under the law, or the Mosaic Law, of which Israel was under in the Old Covenant. All five in Hebrew refer back to the practice that was in existence at the time of Christ and his appearance. Since the references in Matthew and Luke also refer to the Jewish form of tithing under the law, this means that all eight usages of the word tithe in the New Testament, listen, describe the practice as it existed under the revelation given in the Old Testament. The biblical data now presents to us what may be a startling concept to many Christians. And then what we've been working up to. Nowhere in the New Testament is there an express command imposed by God as being it the duty of a Christian to tithe. Nowhere. Not a single commandment is imposed by the progressive revelation of God, inspiring his apostles to give what is the duty of a Christian in the New Testament era. Not a word regarding the matter of tithing. Well, how then do some Bible teachers insist upon it being a Christian duty to tithe? I want to know. I want to know because I used to be in that camp. How do you teach tithing as a Christian duty? In one of two ways. First, some Bible teachers do so by ignoring the change brought about by God in the introduction of a new order of kingdom living known as the New Covenant. just ignoring that, that there has been a change. They then impose the Old Testament references upon Christians, while failing to deal with all the biblical references as they are applied to the Old Testament settings. Now, we've attempted to do that. We've spent 5-6 weeks now working through the Old Testament and through the Intertestament period. And what a Bible teacher does in order to establish that tithing is a Christian duty, he or she jumps back to the Old Testament references, pulls them out, and imposes those upon the consciences of New Testament believers. Now, this leads to several gross inconsistencies. One being the fact that there were three tithes under the Mosaic Covenant, as we have seen, not including the fourth, which was the tithe given to establish the kingdom or the judgment, or rather the government. So the Jews actually gave almost 40% of their income to support the priesthood and the government under Solomon and so forth. Now, the fact then that there were three there under the Mosaic Covenant given to the Hebrews, I ask this question: where is the revelation that reduces this to one tithe of 10% for a Christian? Where is that revelation at? If the Old Testament duty upon a Jewish individual that was religious before God was to give three tithes, then how can you impose it on a Christian as their duty to somehow just reduce that to 10% instead of 30%? It's inconsistent. And this is what Bible teachers are guilty of ignoring all of this data. If you think it's been laborious, it is. And there are a lot of lazy Bible teachers out there who don't want to get into looking at the minute details of how to arrive at conclusions based upon the Scriptures and interpreting them in the light of the evidence found therein. Whenever a Bible teacher seeks to impose the practice of tithing upon a Christian, he or she must impose extra biblical regulations. Thus establishing a Christian Talmud. Alongside the New Testament. I'm going to go back and state that again. Whenever a Bible teacher seeks to impose the practice of tithing upon a Christian, he or she, the Bible teacher, must impose extra biblical regulations. You're going to have to tell them how much, you're going to have to tell them where it goes to, when to give it, how often, and you don't have a single text of Scripture in the New Testament to do that. So you've got to then start a Christian Talmud. Place it alongside the New Testament, and that becomes the authority over the New Testament. Thus, these collection of teachings by these type of Bible teachers and their interpretations become authoritative over the New Testament Scriptures, like the Jewish Talmud did over the Old Testament Scriptures. And this violates the Reformed doctrine of sola scriptura. And again, what does that term mean? Scripture alone. Scripture alone. The second way in which some Bible teachers seek to establish tithing as a Christian duty is to apply the principle of interpretation which says, and we've looked at this, whatever revelation is previously in place cannot be changed unless new revelation replaces it. It is then affirmed that since there is no New Testament revelation which explicitly annuls the practice of tithing, then it comes out of the Old Testament in a continuous form and remains the duty of the Christian. You get the statement? Yes or no? Since there is no New Testament statement that explicitly says you don't have to tithe anymore, then this principle of interpretation then follows. Then you go by what revelation is already in place. And the revelation that's in place is that which comes out of the Old Testament. Therefore, it's carried over into the New Testament. And that is the way that that is argued. Sounds almost like it can't be answered, doesn't it? Well, hang on. Thus, the absence of New Testament references is due to the fact that it is assumed that the practice will continue on. That is the way this is handled. I'll give two examples from two different Bible teachers to illustrate this. They both hold to this same principle. In an article entitled The Law of Moses and the Law of Christ, a teacher by Knox Shamblin comments on Jesus' statement in Matthew 23:23. He says, quote, "As to tithing, the New Testament does not overturn, but rather presupposes the practice. Jesus affirms its correction, while what he deplores is the preoccupation with tithing to the neglect of weightier matters. 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 suggest that the recipient of Christ's riches will be ready not to eliminate the tithe, but to exceed it." End of quote, taken from a book, Continuity and Discontinuity, by John Feinberg, dedicated to the memory of the late S. Lewis Johnson. So you see what the brother is saying. Now, this is a Reformed teacher, I just mentioned, is that Jesus commended the Pharisee for his tithing. Therefore, he didn't annul it. Therefore, he encouraged it to continue on. The second example of how this principle works is that taken by R.C. Sproul. I'll read now Dr. Sproul's article on the question of tithing. He's asked from his book. I have a question. The question is, what do you believe the Bible teaches about tithing as it relates to Christians today? Dr. Sproul says, there are many people who believe that tithing is no longer incumbent upon Christians because it's an Old Testament mandate that is not specifically repeated in the New Testament. Even though this was part of the law of the covenant of Israel in the Old Testament, listen, I don't think that everything God demanded of his people in the Old Testament is abrogated if the New Testament is silent about it. Okay. Remember the two principles that we've given you? I would say that if the tithe were abrogated, we would expect to have an explicit teaching in the New Testament that says that tithing is no longer in effect. Tithing was a responsibility to the old covenant economy and would be carried over, particularly when you understand that the new covenant community was established principally among Jews, who would obviously continue the practice unless they were told that is no longer necessary. Now, boy, that's good logic. It's almost as if there's no answer to this. It sounds like this is the basis that you would need, if a Jew has been practicing tithing, Dr. Sproul is saying, then you would need a statement from God to say it's no longer necessary to tithe. And that isn't found in the New Testament, says Dr. Sproul. I would say that, quoting again from him, I would say that in the absence of any evidence of a repeal, tithing carries through into the New Testament. Going on with his quote, when Jesus was on earth and the new covenant hadn't been established yet, he did bless the Pharisees for their tithe. He rebuked them for failing in weightier matters, but Jesus certainly congratulated them for at least being scrupulous in their tithing. They tithed their mint and their cumin, which meant that they tithed down to the smallest of the things. Most of the tithes in the Old Testament was done agriculturally or with livestock. It was an agrarian society. But these Pharisees were so scrupulous about giving their 10% to God that if they grew a little bit of parsley in the backyard, they tithed that. It would be as if you found a dime on the street and made sure a penny of it went to God. Jesus said that these men were so scrupulous they paid down to the last penny, and he complimented them for that. End of quote. Both of these teachers, Sproul and Chamblin, hold to the idea that tithing carries over from the Old Testament into the New Testament because there is no command in the New Testament for it to cease. Some observations are now in order. Number one, Chamblin's comment about Jesus' approval of the tithing practice of the Pharisees, now listen, fails to consider that while Jesus was on earth, he was under the authority of the law of Moses in its entirety. While he's teaching and giving understandings of what is about to happen out here, he is still under the authority of the law of Moses. From the time that he was born until the time he died on the cross, he must obey to perfection the entirety of the law's commands. He must secure a perfect obedience for us. Even when he was just born, a little baby, his parents had to offer up a certain sacrifice on his behalf. The Redeemer had to be redeemed. There's a sermon on that. From the time he's born till the time he's died, he's made under the law. And he has no liberty to violate any of those commands. And thus he could commend the practice of the Pharisee, even though the Pharisee was going beyond the requirements of the Mosaic code of law and practicing that which the rabbis had explained in the Talmud. But this example that Jesus uses here has nothing to say about tithing as a duty for the Christian under the new covenant, which was ratified after and upon the death of Christ. Christ is never, it has nothing to say, that passage there in Matthew 23. It's still dealing with the Old Testament example, and Christ must uphold those premises there. Secondly, observation. While Sproul does acknowledge that the new covenant had not yet been ratified while Jesus was on earth, neither he nor Chamberlain give any directions as to how many, get my notes here, how many tithes are to be given, how often they're to be given, to whom and where are they to be given. Now here's two tremendous Bible teachers that I can't even hold a shadow to them. And they're saying, now tithing's still in effect, but neither one of them explain how it's implemented. How much are you to give? Sproul mentions 10%, but it was more than 10%. Where do you give it to, R.C.? There's no temple. Well, you give it to the church. Where does the Bible say that? How often do you give it? To whom? And where does it go? And these two teachers have never a word to say about how this is regulated. I asked the question, why do they not do so? Because both of these godly men are committed to sola scriptura. And know that the moment they try to put regulations upon the New Testament practice of tithing, they will impose extra biblical revelation upon the Christian who's living under the new covenant. I submit that if Jesus did not inspire the New Testament apostles to give these details, then no other Bible teacher or church should be permitted to do so. I don't care whether you're R.C. Sproul or you're the Pope of Rome. If Christ did not inspire an apostle to give us the details as to how to regulate tithing in the New Testament era, no Bible teacher and no church has an authority to impose that as a commanded duty upon a Christian. I say this may be shocking to some here tonight, and it may be shocking to a multitude of Christians who have just been raised in a culture in which that they've never questioned this issue of how tithing. They just heard the preacher say, pass the offering plate and be sure you get your tithe and then put your offering in above your tithe on that. Tithes and offerings. Third observation. We're coming to a close now. Neither Sproul nor Chamberlain addresses the fact that the passage in Hebrews does, in fact, annul the regulation for tithing under the Old Covenant. You catch that, Bob? The change of the priesthood made of necessity a change of the law. That's not silence. That's loud revelation. That shakes the whole economy of the old covenant. The temple is rent. I mean, the veil is rent from top to bottom, and the whole system goes with it, including the tithing matter. That's not silence. And both these teachers ignore that. And since we now have no new revelation to replace the revelation which has been canceled, we are now left to other considerations as to what, why, and where a Christian should give in the kingdom of the new covenant. Now, before you go home and tear up your tithing check for Sunday, come back next week, because we may have something to say that may shock us even more than just what we give as 10%. We'll stop there tonight, okay? Jim? Comments, observations. Okay. Ron.
The tower, is that the same thing as the Babylonian tower?
No. That as we gave here a couple of weeks ago, the Talmud started in about 200 B.C. in some of the writings out of Babylon. But it was Jewish. And then it was completed in about 500 A.D., about 700 years, and it's a collection of writings by the Jewish rabbis which attempted to explain case law or examples. You know, like with the Sabbath, they knew that the law of Moses said you don't work. But then somebody had a problem, said, what is work? What can you do and what can't you do? So the rabbi said, we've got to come up with an answer, or else we'll never have the Sabbath. And so they came up with various interpretations. You can only walk so far. So where they came up with this mass of laws that were on the books at the time of Jesus. And that's what Jesus ran into.
In this number to the Romans view of their traditions.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that what we brought out last week? You should have been here last week. No. It's the same thing. It's they needed the Talmud to interpret the Old Testament. And the Roman Church says that you need the church to interpret the New Testament. Now, we can really oppose both of those. But as I brought out last week, you can put the average Baptist preacher in the pulpit and he produces another Talmud. Look at all of the rules and regulations that we put on. Just take that passage right there, let a woman adorn herself and mod it to Pharaoh, read all the books and listen to all the sermons that have been preached on that as to what constitutes modest Pharaoh. I remember the knockdown drag out we had at youth camp back in the, what was it, the 60s? Late 60s.
That youth camp, why every girl had to enter the camp before she signed up, bend on her knees, and if you could see anything below her knees, she was sent home. Above the knee, I'm sorry.
Thank God for a wife.
All right. We had a long, winding stairway that went up to the mess hall. And there would be 700 or 800 kids lined up on that. And all the boys would stand by and look at the girls, look up their skirts. And that was all that was discussed. So it got disgusting. So they gave me an assignment. Research all of this. Come up with a solution. And so I went through the Old Testament and found where the high priest, remember? When he went up on the altar, he was to have his breeches, that is, his underwear, on underneath,
so that his robe would, that if someone wanted to look up his robe, there would be underwear that would cover that. So I came up with the idea, then let's put pants on the girls. Even if they wore them underneath their dresses. And I basically was crucified for that. Because pants was a man's apparel. From Deuteronomy. To wear anything that pertaineth unto a man. And so we never got anywhere. Now then, why did I get off on that? Oh, just what is modest apparel? All right, this is how the rabbis had to come up with all of these things as to how to make Moses' law work. And so you end up with all kinds of extra biblical revelations needed to interpret the Old Testament. And that became more authoritative than the Old Testament, and the Roman Church does the same thing, but we who are not in the Roman Church, we have our traditions too that we established, okay? Thanks, Ron, for your observation there. Very pertinent tonight. Any other before we leave? All right, let's come back then next week and let's start with Jesus' teachings on giving, examples, the widow's mite. Let's work through that, the giving of alms, and let's see in Acts 6 the taking care of the widows, and then with Ananias and Sapphira and them bringing it to the apostles' feet, and then the giving in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. Let's see some of those principles there. And I think that it will help us to see that a Christian ought to be far more generous in their giving because we're under a better covenant with greater responsibilities than even that which they had before. All right? You're dismissed.